I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about big ideas with a modern guy from the old neighborhood who reads around the clock in the realm of the best that has been said and thought in the world and keeps writing what he thinks. George Shialaba is his name. What are intellectuals good for is his question, and it's the title on his collected essays and reviews. George is not a policy wonk. He's not a tenured teacher. He has no seat on any cable TV panel. He's a very private, freelance, public philosopher on the model of Emerson or William James. And the first paradox in our conversation lies in his contention that people like him, who live and die for the big questions of human value, are extinct. George Shialaba, you read to me like the embodiment of exactly what you say is missing in our world. That is, the extensive reader who writes very, very carefully on all sorts of subjects, but above all, the citizen who's writing without a field, without expertise, without a theory, without ideology. What do you mean they've disappeared on us?
Well, I suppose the first explanation for that apparent paradox, if I am what you so generously suggest, is that I don't do it for a living, never have. And I think that, for me, has made all the difference. I don't have to worry this year about who's going to be the editor of X magazine next year. I don't have to worry if it will sound unprofessional to the tenure committee. I don't have to worry if editors just stop being interested in what I have to say. I still have a day job. There are still many more books out there that I'd love to read than I'll ever have time to read. So it's really a take it or leave it proposition for me. And I'm a very pusillanimous intellectual, and I couldn't bravely disregard all of the constraints if I were trying to make a living at it.
We'll get to the constraints. Talk about this cast of heroes that runs through so much of your writing. Some people I know, some I don't. Dwight MacDonald, whom I barely remember. Walter Karp, whom I knew pretty well. Randolph Bourne may be sort of your ultimate model. We associate him with World War I and fighting the rush to war. Cast Randolph Bourne for us.
Well, Randolph Bourne is the great unanswered question in American intellectual life of the first half century. He died at 32, and what he might have become, it's like Robert Kennedy. He was a staggeringly independent figure. There was an anti-war movement in the First World in 1917, but really Bourne had to turn his back on his entire milieu. He was brought up through the New Republic, the Deweyite Columbia circle of philosophers and intellectuals, and he saw through their self-deceptions about the notion that force, American force, could be, should be, put it in the service of American ideals. He saw that essentially the ideals were as they've remained through the Cold War and through the Iraq War and possibly the Balkan War. The ideals have been the marketing strategy, have been the rationale, the force and the unarticulated goals that have always framed American policy decide when force will and will not be used. So he saw that. Dewey didn't see it. Herbert Croly of the New Republic didn't see it. And Bourne said it, and he was shown the door of the New Republic. And then he found another berth in a remarkable new journal, kind of a pre-partisan review called Seven Arts, which was sponsored by a wealthy patron. Although she had a fairly wide tolerance for unorthodox ideas, Bourne was just too much for her, and so she withdrew her support, and the magazine disappeared as a result. Anyway, by the end of the war, Bourne really was homeless. You know, Turgenev has this line, which I quote, "In politics, the honest man will wind up without a home." And so Bourne did. But when the war ended, he was so young and so admirable that he was accepted back into the Atlantic Monthly and the New Republic. And so he restarted his career. And the other very poignant thing about his story is that he was a hunchback. And he was deformed. He didn't have a social life until his mid or late 20s. And in his late 20s, in the last years of his life, he died at 32, a rich and beautiful heiress, young heiress, Esther Cornell, the descendant of Ezra Cornell, who founded the university, fell in love with him, and they were engaged, but he died before they were married. Anyway, it wasn't only her loss. American intellectual life would have... I guess he wasn't a scientist. He really was purely a journalist. He was a kind of Bertrand Russell figure, Orwell figure. He was less earthy than Orwell, less rigorous and erudite and academic than Russell, but he had some qualities of both, and they were lost, except as an inspiration.
Let's speak briefly about Walter Karp, because I remember him so well. He wrote a marvelous book. Every political writer that I know who read it thought it was the best thing they ever read, but no, most people have never heard of it. Indispensable Enemies was about the rule of collusion in American politics, almost from the beginning, that the two parties basically fixed every race, and their whole purpose was to quash insurgency in their own. Sort of, I'll fight back my insurgents and help you fight back yours. He had this other passion about the United States as a republic, lowercase r, but sort of the people, for the people, by the people, not a nation out there striding the world like a colossus. And I remember him so fondly. I don't know how he made do. He smoked too much, drank an awful lot of coffee, but he had that quality of my thinking as my vocation, whatever else.
Well, I wish I'd met Karp, as you did. Indispensable Enemies was a great book, and it saw rightly that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are the two wings of the American bird of prey, as we used to say in the New Left. I discovered him in the 80s in Harper's as a critic of the Reagan Revolution, the Reagan years, and only then read backwards into Indispensable Enemies and The Politics of War, another great book about Wilsonianism, true and false, or real and illusory, which needs to be resurrected in these times when the neoconservatives and even, my God, George Bush are being called Wilsonians. Karp would have scoffed royally at that. Anyway, it was really buried alive, the book in which collected his Harper's essays on Reaganism, that just lit me up. It was a very dark time for someone in his 30s, as I was. Well, the country just seemed to be hoodwinked, and here was someone who wasn't hoodwinked and who was standing up and saying more eloquently than I could have imagined someone saying what a fraud it all was.
You'll be disappointed to hear that I fought with him on that question, and I won't say I defended Ronald Reagan exactly, but I thought Ronald Reagan, and I think the history since then bears out that Ronnie was even second-guessing war, especially nuclear war, but anyway, that's a detail. You range so far among the serious philosophical types like Richard Rorty or Christopher Lash than most of the commentariat does. How far do you read in those exotic fields?
Well, not all that far. It all started in my days as an altar boy. I actually went on to become a member of a peculiar kind of Catholic religious order, Opus Dei, best known as the matrix of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. As an undergraduate, I joined just before entering college, essentially spent college reading and thinking my way out of Counter-Reformation Catholicism. Opus Dei was a very pure version of the Council of Trent's dogmatic pronouncements and in response to Luther. Anyway, they did make you read scholastic philosophy and theology. I do actually, somewhere in the dusty archives of the Pontifical Lateran University in Rome is a certificate of in scholastic philosophy with my name on it.
Wow.
But not a very, believe me, not a very outstanding achievement. I majored in modern intellectual history by way of kind of rebellion. And so framed, my intellectual growth was a was a long argument between orthodoxy and modernity. And to the extent that I come across thinkers who are reframing that great issue, like Rorty especially, and Lash from a very different viewpoint, I'm fascinated, and it strikes a chord that goes very far down. And so it's very kind of purposeful. I really, you know, don't spend evenings curled up with one or another of Kant's treatises. I'm not that pure a lover of philosophy. But certain themes just make me willing and confident enough to go into the philosophical foundations of the question.
What's the core of the modern question for you, the modernity question?
Well, the easy answer, I guess, is Kant's famous motto, sapere aude, dare to know. I suppose that gradually, as more and more things about how the world works were figured out by the first great wave of scientists, Galileo, Kepler, Tycho Brahe, and so on and so on, and as the way the world works as a society began to be figured out through the great commercial revolutions, innovations of the 15th, 16th century, basically science and capitalism created the confidence, that's really what Kant is getting at, created the confidence to simply talk back, or even before that, to just follow one's doubts, recognize one's doubts, allow one's doubts to surface. I'm just going it further and further back into the process of individualism. It just began to be less overwhelmingly certain that the world had supernatural origins and causes, and that human society was ungovernable except by unquestioned and unquestionable codes handed down from on high. So, you know, a molecular process, just one small gain after another, and, you know, by the 15th and 16th century, men were holding their heads up. And that's modernity.
Hmm. Leaping ahead. George Orwell figures so comprehensively in your writing, maybe as the embodiment of that sort of independent mind, the leftish, pragmatic, humanistic, stylish prose. Who is George Orwell to you?
Well, he is actually, now that you mention it, almost above all, a prose writer. The plain style was just a revelation to me. Politics and the English language, a lot of people look down on it nowadays, but I still think it's, you bless it as a kind of baptism for me. It's where I come from. Also, of course, there's his moral example. He really was pretty fearless. He did have some hidebound prejudices, mainly harmless ones. You know, he wasn't the absolutely most penetrating and most eloquent and most complicated thinker, even of his time. He didn't see things that Bertrand Russell or D.H. Lawrence or Merleau-Ponty saw. I don't think he had much of a glimmer about the philosophy of history or Marxism, or not that it's not all right to see through Marxism, but I don't think he even got that far. But mainly his prejudices were innocuous, and there were very few of them, and he was always willing to be called on them, and he just was an entirely, maybe even a better word than fearless is unself-important. He just had no ambition beyond figuring out and telling the truth, and that's surprisingly rare.
And then there were the so-called New York intellectuals, the Partisan Review crowd, Daniel Bell, Irving Howe, Irving Kristol, Norman Mailer, in a certain significant way. The question that you wrestle with again in your book is, why didn't they reproduce?
Well, let me plug a friend's book as part of the answer to that question. Vivian Gornick has a marvelous short book called The Men in My Life. It started out as a Harper's essay a couple of years ago. It's about the end of Jewish American, the Jewish American novel. And it's not really a story of decline. It's an explanation of Bellow, Roth, Malamud, of the rise. It's really a story more of the rise of the great mid-century American Jewish novelists. And it sets their achievement in the context of the epic American story of Jewish American assimilation. And that, I think, is a large part of the story of the great efflorescence of the mid-century Jewish American public intellectuals. They were fighting for a place in the American sun, as well as all of the other good causes that they... I mean, part of what gave an impetus above and beyond simple love of art, as in Meyer Shapiro's and Harold Rosenberg's case, or love of literature, as in Irving Howe's and Philip Robb's case, there was also this desire to conquer a significant corner of American intellectual life and become full Americans. And they did, and we're all vastly richer for it. But once a goal like that has been achieved, the next generation has to find another goal. And Jewish American intellectuals, they're still many, if not most, of the stars in the American intellectual constellation today, but they don't have quite the same stakes as the earlier ones did, I think.
Tony Judt of NYU would also argue that they have significantly abandoned their liberal standards of the, say, of the Vietnam period, and went very, very silent in the around the Iraq War. Do we know why?
Well, we can, if we dare, conjecture about it. In 1967, really, everything changed. Most of the partisan review crowd were pretty detached from, even kind of sort of skeptical about Israel between 1948 and 1967. I mean, they were, if it had appeared a life and death issue, there's no question what side would have had their allegiance, but it didn't. It didn't for those 20 years. And Israel just didn't loom large in the larger American consciousness or all that large in Jewish American consciousness. But in 1967, the alarm bells rang. Irving Howe has very vividly described about how he woke up and was scared to death for Israel's survival, and just began from that moment to be very passionate about the subject. And I think that's true of a lot of American intellectuals. Few of them retained Howe's intellectual flexibility on the subject. Most of them were older by a decade or so than Howe, and some were Howe's contemporaries like Podoretz, but were many decades older mentally and psychologically, and just became very crotchety and inflexible, diehard defenders of not of Israel, but of the right wing of Israeli politics. So that's the atmosphere, and they had the big guns, and they have dominated Jewish American intellectual life. And they've managed to convince the growing generation, mostly at least many, that Israel is in peril, and it's the duty of all everyone with a public voice, above all, to defend it, that non-Jews, really can't be fair, can't do justice, etc. It's rarely presented that starkly, and many, many Jews do have decent liberal attitudes toward, but they've had to struggle a bit, and it's just been a break on the same kind of intellectual daring and fearlessness that the earlier generation of the mid-century Jewish American intellectuals achieved.
Is it possible to look back on the Iraq War now as a kind of maybe an invention of the intellectuals, but a failure on the part of the intellectuals to see the stakes and to speak up about it?
Well, I have something of a doctrinaire materialist perspective on the origin of the Iraq War. I don't hold intellectuals very much responsible for it. I think it was a calculated, cold-blooded imperialist venture. I think that Saddam had looked to be an unreliable client, ally, to Rumsfeld, Cheney, and their brain trust or strategic brain trust in the energy and defense industries. I mean, that's whose eyes they see the world with. The idea was Saddam is a loose cannon. Let's see if he makes a false step. And so when September 11th happened, the same day or the next day, Rumsfeld is quoted by one of his aides as saying, "This is our chance. We'll get rid of Saddam." They got rid of him in order to build as they have, as they began immediately to do after the fall of Baghdad, four or five large, enormous military bases, permanent military bases. They nurtured this group of Iraqi exiles whom they thought they would very easily slide into place in first a provisional government and then an elected government, who would immediately sign a status of forces agreement and an oil exploitation agreement with the United States, which would give the Pentagon and the energy industry everything they wanted. And I suppose a tertiary but still important result would be that they would write the Iraqi constitution from scratch and make it a kind of demonstration. I mean, if Chile after Pinochet was a kind of Chicago school model of the economy, this would be the stuff of Milton Friedman's dreams. It was a completely deregulated state, an investor's paradise. So these were their goals in Iraq. The intellectuals were useful idiots, in the old Stalinist phrase. I don't doubt that the liberal internationalists, George Packer, Kanan Makiya, Paul Berman, thought, however, foolishly, that the United States was sincerely interested in advancing democratic institutions in the Middle East. But I myself think that's so implausible that I can barely get angry at them. And I think that they themselves had so little influence in the councils of state that I don't really blame them. I think the larger treason of the intellectuals is, it's not even a treason, it's just a vast shortcoming. I mean, the story of humankind until 1948 or so was of sovereign nation states that made war with virtually no legal constraint. I mean, there was a just war theory, which some nations gave lip service to, and most didn't even bother. But in 1948, having witnessed the Holocaust, both in the technical Jewish sense and in the larger sense of 50 million people killed, weapons of mass destruction inaugurated, the peoples of the world solemnly assembled and you know, vowed it must never happen again. It's not only the Nazi Holocaust that never again applies to. So they wrote an international constitution, the Charter of the United Nations, the International Declaration of Human Rights, to my mind, the greatest achievements of international diplomacy. And they have been, in the succeeding 60 years, eroded, and now very seriously eroded. And a large part of the responsibility, along with, of course, the Russians and everybody else, but a large part of the responsibility has to go to the most powerful nation, to the dominant state in the international community in those 60 years, us. And the American intelligentsia just has not begun to reckon with the enormous tragedy that the loss of this opportunity to create a law-abiding international culture represents, and in particular, to come to grips with the U.S. responsibility for it. Or share of the responsibility for it.
George, that sets the bar very, very high. But let's take that challenge. The question in your book is, in the title, what are intellectuals good for? But the recurring question is, where have they gone? Give us the short form, and then we'll talk about the university's part, journalism's part, our own part.
Well, the short answer is the world has grown too big. It's just too hard to have a handle on it all. Really, Matthew Arnold was complaining about it, I quote him in the book, 100 years ago and more. Even then, it was getting beyond the power of a single mind to put it all together, just to unify in one mind all of the swimming phenomena. Now it's just vertigo, it's vertigin. I mean, you can't keep up, even with the digests. I mean, you can't even keep a superficial view of the sciences, arts, politics. There's just too much. So insofar as the intellectuals of the mid-century spoke with a kind of cultural authority that impressed everybody, felt free to pronounce on everything, they were lucky enough to live while that was still even remotely plausible. It isn't anymore.
Let me try out another theory, though. I'm sure you know edge.org. It's a kind of loose fraternity of particularly scientists, but the premise is that the real public intellectuals that are shaping our world today, and maybe rescuing it conceivably, come out of the sciences, the biological sciences, maybe the environmental sciences too, the behavioral sciences, the brain sciences. People like Jared Diamond, for example, Guns, Germs, and Steel. I mean, a medical doctor, but an anthropologist and a bird man and extraordinarily wide range. Steve Pinker, the brain scientist, is a kind of symbol of the whole group. What do you make of that notion that the torch has passed, perhaps, from the old humanists and the literary guys to something quite different, and maybe just in time?
Well, edge.org is a great example. It's a marvelous website and some of the best conversation out there on the net. I mean, even scientists can't put all of science together. You know, there are an awful lot of people who think that Steven Pinker has become a performer, even though I still admire the hell out of him. Or Jared Diamond. There are lots of colleagues who delight in pointing out that that he's just a preacher. So they pay a price professionally when they generously enter the public square and try to become something like public intellectuals. It hasn't constrained all of them, or, you know, the ones we've been speaking of, the ones you cited, E.O. Wilson, Stephen Gould, although they've all achieved certain eminence before they presume to speak out, which itself is a kind of filter. Yes, I think they do know the most important things now. And yes, we ought to listen to them. And yes, science is, it's what Alastair McIntyre in After Virtue made famous as the term practice, that is a kind of way, a way of life, or at least an activity that has large implications for life, that that is complex, that's ramified, that is handed down from one, from teacher to student and so on. And the practice of science is itself enlightening, liberating, character building. Scientists are people, if not the people, that we have to attend to, that we can't get it right without paying more attention to than we did a couple of generations ago. On the other hand, the roots, the primal wellsprings of our common morality, civic and social and ethical, are still verbal. They're the Bible, they're Shakespeare, they're Homer, they're the great traditions of lyric poetry in whichever language you speak. And the chords to which we vibrate most deeply can only be sounded by people who have deeply assimilated those sources and can kind of bring them up from their own depths when appropriate and into the public conversation and make other people vibrate to them. Scientists may be very well read, but by and large, they're, you know, well, there's only so much one human imagination can compass, and scientists can't do that quite as readily as humanists. So there's still an important part of us that only humanists can speak to, I'd say.
Picking up on the public conversation idea, two questions. One, where's the media? And put it narrowly, why is The New Yorker getting thinner and thinner and thinner? Why is The New York Review of Books getting fatter and fatter and fatter? Why are more and more people reading The London Review of Books online? I mean, what is going on out there in the, shall we say, the higher public conversation?
Well, I'm not very plugged in. The great rock critic Lester Bangs had a saying, I'm not cool. I never go out anywhere. And that's kind of my lifestyle, too.
That's your pose, George. Be real.
Well, I suppose what happened is that a capitalism, as Marx foretold, it went from entrepreneurial to financial. Now, how does that, what does that have to do with anything? Well, entrepreneurs like Andrew Carnegie, Andrew Mellon, the people who started the Times and the Globe, the families that produced great wealth and great public benevolence, you know, they were a kind of economic royalty, as Franklin Roosevelt angrily and quite rightly pointed out. But they also had some sense of noblesse oblige. They founded libraries, they founded musical academies, conservatories, symphony orchestras, and newspapers, and media, magazines, universities. And they founded them from a sense of civic obligation, which was just much more alive in America formerly than it is now. So they didn't maximize their profits. That just wasn't what they were investing in those institutions for the sake of. Now, as the world turned, they had to modernize. They had to invest in capital and human resources. They had to go to banks and other sources of investment capital. They had to get money from people who were interested, primarily and only in maximizing their profits. That was a necessity of competition, a necessity of the marketplace, and they had to obey it, and that was the fateful step that eventually turned the media into, and culture generally, into a more commercial enterprise. Harvard has a saying, I have a clerical job at Harvard, and so I've heard this saying many times, every tub on its own bottom, which means that every school has to have its own sources of support, its own budget. And it's not quite as cold-blooded the way it works out as that, but it's somewhat cold-blooded. Harvard is not a generous parent that bails out any of its institutional children that are in trouble. And that's just how culture generally operates now. Every tub on its own bottom, every institution has to show a profit. It's good that it's not a rich man's toy, I suppose, but some rich men had noble impulses, whereas investment banks legally can't, are not allowed to.
This prompts the university question. There's a thread in your book that somehow the modern university, post-World War II, destroyed the intellectual class, the notion of these independent thinkers that we're memorializing or longing for. How could that be?
Well, listeners, and possibly you, I won't look directly at you when I say this, will roll their eyes, raise their eyebrows, but I find it yet another aspect of the materialist theory of capitalist development. I mention in the first two essays, the kind of thematic essays of the book, the rise of the industries of manufacturing consent, public relations, advertising primarily. As mass society matured, as workers needed to be literate simply to do the jobs that would produce the profits, mass education became a necessity. Obviously, this was, as I say, a necessity of capitalist development, but also it posed the great danger that people would become enamored of, dedicated to self-determination, and would begin to ask, well, why doesn't self-determination apply to the way we produce our life in common and not merely to this restricted, fenced-off realm called politics? That is, they might start asking the radical questions that led to the invention, not by Marx, but by many other people before and since Marx, of socialism. So this education had to become another area in which consent was manufactured, or at least obtained. And so businesses began to dominate the boards of trustees of educational institutions. They became large investors in educational institutions. They began to pay close, intense attention to government support for educational institutions, and they were not slow to make their unhappiness known when people began to rise to authority and influence within academic disciplines who had unwelcome, unorthodox, subversive opinions. And this has now, I mean, there wasn't ever a Kulturkampf in the universities. There wasn't ever a purge. It wasn't necessary. Business and the priorities of a business civilization have, with great sort of subtlety and universality, made themselves felt in the sensibilities of university presidents, deans, foundation heads. And it flows downward, again, without explicit articulation, but it's the consensus. The creation of the consensus is a very molecular, again, very subtle, complicated thing, but the universities and the rest of culture have essentially all become dependent on business and government and have gradually, subtly internalized the constraints that inevitably entails. Who pays the piper calls the tune.
Okay, I have a serious dissent on this point, and maybe you'll shoot me down, but it seems to me, in fact, George, the time is ripe for a kind of new university spokesmanship, now more than ever maybe, rooted in the humanities, and maybe concentrated here in Boston, Cambridge. I can't imagine a richer cast any time in our history of both scientists and humanists in this neighborhood. I mean, they're without number, but I think of Elaine Scarry, for example, who crosses all sorts of bounds, is very brave about saying all sorts of things. Homi Bhabha, a very different sort of intellectual. Louis Menand, now in the Harvard faculty. Sven Burkitts, a writer you and I both know, an editor. Henry Louis Gates. There are all sorts of them. It seems to me the time is ripe, and the internet is the instrument to reassert, to force these minds to speak up in a more public way. And I wonder if you're not giving up the game before it's even well begun. Is there not a quorum within 10 miles of where we sit here in the heart of Boston to fire up a public conversation that you want?
Well, I'm not a pessimist, but I'm a skeptic. My idea of a democratic culture is people sitting on the subway, you know, half of them reading one newspaper, half of them reading another, or maybe a third and a third and another third of them.
Have you noticed they read books now? Not papers, but go ahead.
Well, I have noticed some people reading books, but an awful lot of people sit there with buds in their ears, listening to their iPods. But anyway, my idea is that in the subways, in the workplaces, in coffee shops, people would be sharing political, cultural, ideological experiences. You see the guy across the room reading, you know, Chris Lydon's column in Today's Globe, and, you know, maybe maybe not a guy you don't know, but, you know, in the lounge, in your office, your company office, and you say, boy, that Lydon, he's a mensch. Or you say, boy, that Lydon, he's a shithead.
Or he's wrong again today, yeah.
Right. And a conversation starts. What starts conversations is some kind of common experience. So people do have these conversations on the net, but nonetheless, we live in neighborhoods still. We work in workplaces still. We use public transportation still, and hopefully more and more as we begin to come to our senses environmentally. And these are all very good, even essential, I would say, places to have conversations, because many of these political conversations have to be about the neighborhood and about the workplace. So, you know, it's harder to talk about those things, although still possible online and individually. It's good still to get together.
George, I'm the guy on the subway who, when I see somebody sort of tapping their foot or zoning out with something they're listening to, I go over and ask them, you know, what is it? I believe in the eye contact factor and the direct conversation in the coffee shop, but I also think there's an architecture in the web for precisely the kind of conversation that you want. I think the trick is, as they say at Meetup, or quoting Timothy Leary, find the others. Find the others who will engage. But I think the tools are there, and I think the brains are there. Last thing, what would your specifications be for, shall we say, the postmodern intellectual? Who's the ideal you're looking for? I think you're the ideal I'm looking for, but who are you looking for?
I think postmodernity is premature. I think we ought to postpone postmodernity for a few centuries, at least. I don't think modernity has exhausted its potential. And as a matter of fact, the very sad fact is that 9/10 of the world or 8/10 or 7/10 has not even entered modernity. This is a grave, terrible indictment of us who have. We need to stop improving our lifestyles and just start inviting, at least, pulling up people who are trying to climb into modern political and literary and intellectual and scientific culture. When nobody is getting less than 2,000 calories of culture or food a day, you know, then we can take off into the postmodern future together. But now it just looks like we're really heading for species division. Some people are on such a fast track to the future that when other people are sunk in pre-modern misery, and it's just not a healthy prognosis for the species.
So who then are we looking for in the way of an example?
Well, culturally, I guess I'd say Wendell Berry and Sven Burkertz, people who have a sense that there are vast unexplored riches in the printed word, in the case of Burkertz, in the natural world, in the case of Berry. People like Ralph Nader, who have a sense of the vast riches of the civic realm, they seem to be the exemplary modern men. And I don't think we should try to extend or go past their example right now so much as to emulate it en masse.
How about our president? I was thrilled to see it, just a throwaway note, in a conversation about economics in the New York Times. He was asked, what are you reading these days? And he said, well, on my night table is Netherland, a novel by Joseph O'Neill, post 9/11 novel about New York from an international perspective, a Dutch investment guy who's crazy about cricket. And it's all about the discovery of this open secret of third world cricket in Staten Island, but all over New York. Pacs and Indians and Caribbeans and Australians and Europeans and whatnot. It's as good a novel as I've read in the last 5 years, and there it is on the president's table.
Well, I wish he'd said he were reading Bleak House, as you are, I notice. I admire Obama. I've read his two books and was impressed by them. But there's an old saying, the mills of God grind slow but sure, and the mills of American politics grind slow but sure. And I fear that decent and literate as he is, he'll be ground down, alas.
I'm betting against it. I also think the first qualification for people in the new conversation will be that they have read this wonderful collection of essays, What Are Intellectuals Good For? The answer being, they're good for essays and reviews by George Shalaba. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.